We're in the book of Deuteronomy, chapter number 23, and we're going to start in verse 21 in just a moment. Remember that Moses is retelling the law, and that's why it's so random, all the different things that he talks about here, so many different topics, because he's trying to cram all of this review material into the hearts and the minds of his students over the past 40 years, before he dies and they go into the promised land without him. As the prophet of God, he is well aware that they are going to have a hard time being obedient to the word. And so he wants them to have a lot of review in order to encourage them to do their best to stick with the covenant. So we'll hop through quite a few different things here. And as I've said over the last few days, there will be material in this teaching today that is probably best for older children rather than the younger set. So if you would like to avoid having any serious topic conversations with your younger kids, go ahead and get them busy somewhere else, or just turn off the radio and listen to it later by way of the internet so that you can get the teaching without having to have these conversations ahead of their time. Okay, Deuteronomy chapter 23, verse 21. Here's the topic. If you make a vow to He who is your God, so a solemn promise in the name of God, you shall not delay fulfilling it, for He who is your God will surely require it of you, and you will be guilty of sin. That is, if you make the promise in the name of God and then don't carry through with the promise. This topic has a New Testament twist on it, that we're taught by Jesus and by his half-brother James that we shouldn't be making vows at all. We should simply let our language be yes means yes and no means no, and maybe means maybe. We should try not, or we shouldn't try to take advantage of wording and phraseology as to whether or not we will keep our word. We just need to keep it. And if you do make a promise in the name of the Lord, you need to follow through with it. That's just the way that it works. Because otherwise, you're using the name of the Lord your God in vain. Verse 22. But if you refrain from vowing, you will not be guilty of sin. So if you don't make the vow, and you can't follow through with what you'd hope to do, then you haven't violated anything. Verse 23, you shall be careful to do what has passed your lips, for you have voluntarily vowed to He who is your God what you have promised with your mouth. And I'd like to offer a little bit of encouragement to parents out there. There is nothing wrong with telling your kids, maybe. There is something seriously wrong with telling your kids yes and then not doing it, because you made a promise. That's what we're talking about here. You need to follow through with it. So think before you speak. Your children will hold you to it. Whatever you said you would do, they're going to expect you to follow through with it, which is only fair. So I think it is a good habit to get into of using the word maybe a lot with your kids. Okay? Verse number 24. Change the topic. If you go into your neighbor's vineyard, you may eat your fill of grapes, as many as you wish, but you shall not put any in your bag. If you go into your neighbor's standing grain, you may pluck the ears with your hand, but you shall not put a sickle to your neighbor's standing grain. All right, this is the practicality of Israel's agricultural situation in the theocracy of God. That is, God is the king, God owns the land, and God actually owns the crops on the land. It's just that certain people are managing those crops in his name. And that's the hereditary territory that's given once they arrive in the promised land. So with all of that being the principle, God gives permission. If you're hungry and you're walking through a vineyard, you may eat grains to satisfy, or eat the grapes to satisfy your hunger. That's it. Nothing more. You can't start collecting it up to take home with you for many meals later or to sell it, because it's not yours. It belongs to God and to the person that's putting the hard work into growing it. So you would be cheating, you would be stealing, if you took more than just simply what satisfied your hunger. Same thing with the grain. We see an episode of where the apostles and Jesus, they're walking through the middle of a grain field and they get hungry. So they just reach over and snap off the grain heads. They rub them between their hands to break the grain heads out of their sheath. And then they blow at it to get the chaff away. And then they start eating the little kernels of grain. That was perfectly legitimate by Jewish law. They had God's permission to eat just enough to satisfy their hunger. What they couldn't do was stuff their pockets full or stuff a bag full, because that would be stealing. Now, interestingly enough, in the story that I just told, the thing that got the Pharisees all upset was they were doing that on the Sabbath day. And so they believed, by their standard, their Pharisaical standard, that the apostles were engaging in harvest, in threshing, and winnowing by snapping the grain heads off, rubbing them between their fingers, and blowing the chaff away. Of course, that was not the case, but the Pharisees had this problem with over-applying Scripture. Okay, back to the text, verse 1 of chapter 24. New topic, and a pretty big one that we have to go to the New Testament and talk about. When a man takes a wife and marries her, if then she finds no favor in his eyes because he has found some indecency in her. Now, obviously, if she got busted in an adulterous affair, there would be no question but that there would be an execution involved. So this is something different than that, and yet something along the lines of maybe something not quite right sexually. So what does Moses go on to say? And he writes a certificate of divorce and puts it in her hand and sends her out of his house, and she departs out of his house. Now, that's all still preliminary to what he really wants to say, which we're going to go to next. We'll come back to the idea that Moses introduces here, the idea of a problem in the marriage and a divorce certificate that is issued and she leaves. Okay, we'll come back to that, I promise. Verse 2, if she goes out and becomes another man's wife, and the latter man hates her, you know, ceases to want to be married to her, and writes her a certificate of divorce and puts it in her hand and sends her out of his house, or if the latter man dies, who took her to be his wife, then her former husband who sent her away may not take her again to be his wife after she's been defiled or after she's been involved with another man. For that is an abomination before he who is. And you shall not bring sin upon the land that he who is your God is giving you for an inheritance. So the main point of this section is actually the thing that we don't usually talk about. And that is, God through Moses says, If you get divorced and you move on to a new marriage, and then that marriage fails or ends, you should not be going back to the original marriage that blew up, that resulted in divorce, because you've already moved on from there. That's the main point for the Israelis to take away from this. But that's not the main point that they focused on. Instead, they focused on the idea of, what are my rights for divorce? What are my legitimate reasons to get divorced? And the Pharisees, who became the experts in the law during the 2 centuries previous to Jesus' time, they broke up into 2 different schools of thought on this topic, and they both of them applied it from Deuteronomy 24. The one school of thought was, Moses was only talking about sexual problems, sexual issues, maybe even just the suspicion that your wife is somehow involved in an affair somewhere else. That's the reason for divorce, and only that. The other school of thought, which was the majority school of thought, this is what the majority of religious Jews believed during the time of the New Testament, that Moses gave permission for absolutely any reason to divorce your wife. And the usual jokey explanation is, if she burned the toast, if she burned the bread, that was good enough for you to say, I'm done with you. You've burned the toast for the last time. We're divorced. You're out of here. And that this more liberal and larger group in the first century believed that that was perfectly appropriate, just as long as you did the paperwork. So this became a major topic for Jesus to be confronted with by the Pharisees, because they saw this as a wedge issue. You know what I mean by wedge issue? If they push this hard enough, they can separate Jesus from the people who liked him. So Matthew chapter number 19 is where I'm looking at next. Verse number 3. And this is taking place just a few weeks, days before Jesus has his final week at Jerusalem. The Pharisees came up to him and tested him by asking, is it lawful to divorce one's wife for any cause? So they are presenting the idea of the majority viewpoint. That is, you can ditch your wife for any reason you want. So they think that they can get Jesus in trouble with the majority of religious Jews of his day by this topic, because they know how he feels, because this topic has come up before, and he does not agree with that majority opinion. So he answered, have you not read that he who created them from the beginning made them male and female, and said, therefore a man shall leave his father and his mother and hold fast to his wife, and the two shall become one flesh? So they are no longer two, but one flesh. What therefore God has joined together, let no man separate. So Jesus answers the question by going to the scripture. He goes to Genesis, and he talks about the beginnings of everything, that God had designed man and woman to be a pair. One gender, male, one gender, female, that would then come together to make a marriage. And once that marriage happened, once that commitment was made, it was supposed to be for a lifetime. And actually, if we get to the truth of Genesis, it was to be for eternity. Because when marriage was first issued or designed with Adam and Eve, it was before sin came into the world, before death came into the world. So marriage was supposed to be for eternity in its original state. So Jesus' response was basically, no. Don't you pay attention to Scripture? God intended marriage to last, not to end. So their response, verse 7 of Matthew 19, they said to him, well, why then did Moses command one to give a divorce, a certificate of divorce, and to send her away? So notice their wording is not quite correct. Moses didn't order people to divorce, even though they kind of phrase it that way. Moses said, if you do divorce, you have to give paperwork. There has to be legitimacy to it. So they say, okay, well, if marriage is supposed to be lasting forever, lasting for a lifetime, why did Moses say we could divorce? And he said back to them, verse 8, because of the hardness of heart, Moses allowed you to divorce your wives. But from the beginning, it was not so. So he corrects them. He says, Moses didn't tell you you had to get divorced. He gave you permission to divorce your wives and to write out the legal paperwork because you guys have a hard heart. Because you would want to do it regardless. So he wanted it to have some sort of legitimacy. But then listen to the next thing that Jesus says. I say to you, whoever divorces his wife except for sexual immorality and marries another commits adultery. So Jesus' standard was the hard-lined standard. That is, there has to be something sexually wrong in the marriage for divorce to take place. Otherwise, you're ditching her for no good reason. Now, don't get distracted by the fact that later in the New Testament, Paul goes on and talks about the idea of abandonment, the idea that you've got a couple that is mixed, that is, the husband, for example, is an unbeliever, and the wife has become a believer, and then the husband doesn't want the wife around anymore if she's going to be that way, so he divorces her, and that, Paul says, frees the wife to pursue a new marriage because she has no control over what her unbelieving husband's going to do. The fact that he ditched her is not her fault. So that is a separate topic on this issue of divorce. Jesus is answering the question from Deuteronomy 24. What did Moses mean when he wrote, and let's read it again here, if then she finds no favor in his eyes because she's found some, or he's found some indecency in her. What's that word indecency mean? And Jesus says, we're talking about some sort of sexual issue. She has a problem. Maybe he suspects her of playing around, but he can't prove it. Moses says, well, if you're going to quit loving her and being committed to her, at least give her a certificate of divorce. And then don't be trying to take her back later after she marries somebody else and then he divorces her as well. So that's the point of Deuteronomy 24. And Jesus' response is what we, as Bible-believing Christians, gauge our attitude on. And that is, there has to be a serious breach of the relationship between the husband and wife for divorce to be legitimate. And it's typically thought of in the terms of sexual immorality. Pragmatically, and I'm going to give you my opinion on this, okay? Pragmatically, I think that would include husbands who get caught up in pornography and start having strange relationships that do not involve their wife. That is definitely a problem that needs to be addressed. And if it can't be fixed, then it would certainly, I think, in my opinion, be grounds for divorce under the words of Jesus here. Okay? Now, let's keep the context of the first century in mind here with the way that the apostles respond to this, because it's shocking to us. The disciples, verse 10 of Matthew 19, said to him, "Well, if such is the case of a man with his wife, it's better not to marry." So effectively, the apostles are like, "You're kidding. You mean there is no real wide range of reasons I can divorce my wife? Then I would probably be better off never getting married in the first place if I'm going to be stuck with her." Now, that is totally rude against these guys' wives. Just totally. I mean, let's be honest about that. But it reflects the culture of the majority viewpoint on Matthew 24 at this time. Now, Jesus' response comes off almost a little tongue-in-cheek, I think. He said, "Not everyone can receive this saying, but only those to whom it's been given." Meaning, there's not an awful lot of guys that can go through life without getting married. So that's not what they should be taking away from this. For there are eunuchs who have been made so from birth, and there are eunuchs who have been made eunuchs by men, and there are eunuchs who have made themselves eunuchs for the sake of the kingdom of heaven. Let the one who is able to receive this receive it. So Jesus kind of gets into the area that Paul talks about later, and that is when you get married, you've got commitments. You've got a commitment to your wife, and you've got a commitment to your kids. And some people feel not very committed to those sorts of relationships. And those people shouldn't get married, and some of them are not even interested in getting married. Paul, when he writes to the Corinthians, he's concerned about persecutions that are happening and growing within the church. And he even gives the advice that people in the church ought to be like himself, single. Because a single man can be fully committed to God and God alone, and he doesn't have to worry about other people being impacted by his work to God. And that's all true. I mean, I've shared this when we've gone through the Corinthian passage. It is one thing for someone to put a gun to your head and say, "Deny Christ or die." And I hope the majority of us would have no problem going, "Pull the trigger, buddy. You're just sending me home early." It's a totally different thing for them to take a gun and put it to the head of your beloved wife or your children, and for them to say, "Deny Christ or I blow them away." There's a lot of pressure that comes from that. So marriage is a lifetime commitment. And marriages should never be entered into lightly and without forethought of it being for a lifetime. And once you're in a marriage, you need to be fully committed to that marriage and work hard at it. And if you're having a hard time, you need to get help from legitimate authorities that have Bible background to get whatever it is that's going on in your marriage badly fixed. Because God had intended marriage to be one man, one woman, together for a lifetime. Okay, let's go ahead and get back to Deuteronomy 24:5 now. Still talking about marriage, but from a slightly different angle. When a man is newly married, he shall not go out with the army or be liable for any other public duty. he shall be free at home 1 year to be happy with his wife whom he has taken. We saw this in some of the rules regarding militia call-ups, because the Israelis were supposed to have a militia. And so every able-bodied man could be called at a moment's notice out to be part of the army. But you remember that one of the things that the commanders were supposed to check on first thing is, are you newly engaged or are you newly married? If so, you're dismissed. We don't need your assistance. Well, here is the same sort of application. Spend a year with your wife, more than likely ending up with your first child that you can spend some time with. And then you can start taking those civic responsibilities back on again, those public responsibilities. Verse number 6. No one shall take a mill or an upper millstone in pledge, for that would be taking a life in pledge. Now, these are things that were used to process grain into flour. And they were valuable enough that a person who might need to put some collateral up could count this as valuable enough to serve as collateral. But Moses says, don't count something like this as collateral because it is too important to daily life. Back at that time, they did not buy flour at the store. You had grain, usually grain you grew, in storage, and you ground it every single day into the amount of flour that you needed to bake the food, the bread for that day. So you can't take that away from a person. Otherwise, you're going to cause them to starve. You're going to cause them to go without food. So mills are off limits for collateral. Well, we're out of time for the day, so we'll come back to this grouping of all sorts of laws and legal precedents tomorrow when we get back into the Word.